Hi, I'm Rick Nelson, and this is episode number 89 of PsyCop Talks Winter Ops, the podcast devoted to all things winter maintenance. This one's about salt, and it's called It's About the Speed. Now, there are a lot of ways we use salt in winter operations, from solids to pre-wet, brines, straight up or blended, and combinations of all of the above. Regardless of how you use it, there's a lot of chemistry going on when you blend it up or you put it out on a snow-packed or about-to-be-snow-packed road. Our guest for this episode is Dr. Scott Kofod, who's an inorganic chemist with 30 years of experience researching various aspects and uses of salt, which includes our business of winter maintenance. Now, a few years back, I was at a TRB function where Dr. Scott was speaking, and the things he was saying about the chemistry of salt touched on so many of the questions that I had been hearing in other conversations with winter maintenance folks. During our visit that became this episode, we touched on a variety of aspects of salt and the chemistry that's taking place when you put it out on the road, but about 30 minutes in, the conversation turned to pre-wetting, and it was a real eye-opener for me, a light bulb moment, if you will, and that became the inspiration for the title of this episode. So here's PsyCop Talks Winter Ops, episode number 89, It's About the Speed, with Dr. Scott Kofod. Is it okay if I just call you Scott, or
of course,
or
no,
Dr. Scott,
No. Yes, Scott. Let's. Many of my colleagues call me Dr. Scott. I hope affectionately, I'm not particular about the doctor moniker. So Scott would be fantastic.
Okay. So Scott, let's get started. Let me ask you just a quick question. You've been in this business of salt chemistry for 30 years plus?
Yes.
What got you started? What piqued your interest that said, I want to do this the rest of my life?
My career started as a research chemist for the Cargill salt business. As a matter of fact, the reason I was originally hired way back in the day was 30-some years ago, Cargill Salt was at the time doing exploration and development of corrosion-inhibited de-icing salt products. And they were looking for someone who had some expertise in corrosion science. I actually did not have any direct experience in corrosion science, but I had experience in electrochemistry. And corrosion is basically an electrochemical phenomenon. And so when I found out that they were looking for someone who might be able to help them develop some corrosion-inhibited de-icers, before my interview, I went to the library and I took out 3 books on corrosion science. And I learned as much as I could about corrosion science in the week before my interview, and the rest is history, as they say. So I was working on developing new products related to de-icing from, I'd say, the very beginning that I started with Cargill over 30 years ago. And over that time, I have had the good fortune that I've been encouraged to continue research into de-icers. So that includes, exploring and trying to develop new products, but also exploring more about how de-icers work, how they perform, and hopefully I've been able to provide a little bit of additional understanding to our industry about how these products and chemicals work, among mm-hmm. obviously many other people.
Right. Scott, a lot of times, question that folks ask is, well, how does the lab relate to reality? It seems like there's an awful lot of research that's being done out there in chemical use and different kinds of de-icing strategies and that sort of thing. And I always hear, well, what happens in the lab doesn't necessarily mean that's going to happen, out in the field. What's your take on that?
Oh, it's an excellent question. And so quite naturally, we rely on long-term practical real-world field experience to teach us how to use these various products and techniques. Over the past 20 years or so, our industry has made enormous strides in developing new techniques, tools, chemicals to enable us to meet the challenges of de-icing. Now, the challenge being we need to get those roads safe as quickly as possible following a snowstorm while minimizing costs and especially environmental impact. So we've made great strides in doing that by developing a broad range of techniques that just weren't there 60 years ago. So nowadays, it's much more sophisticated than you put down salt and you plow. Mm-hmm. It's probably always been more sophisticated than that. But nowadays, especially, we've got pre-wetting, and we've got anti-icing, and we've got direct liquid application de-icing. We've got slurry de-icing and shake and bake de-icing. And then we've got, as liquids have become more and more important, we've got a ever wider range of liquids to use. We've got plain salt brine, magnesium and calcium chloride brines, blends, various performance enhancers, thickeners, corrosion inhibitors, organic-based performance enhancers. So the bottom line is there is a lot more to understand now in order to take maximum benefit of the de-icing tools that we have available to do de-icing most efficiently, both from a cost and environmental standpoint. And while we will always rely on experience in the field as the ultimate arbiter of how a particular product or chemical works and rely on that field experience to teach us how to use them, there are a number of aspects to de-icer performance that are very difficult to understand precisely based on field experience alone. The field, obviously being real world, it is a lousy place to make measurements. A lousy laboratory. Conditions in the field are too complicated. They are too variable. And in the laboratory, we can nail down conditions. We can make precise measurements. And it's possible to gain insights on how different chemicals, different application techniques perform under different conditions, how they compare to each other, what they can do, what they cannot do, how they actually work. So we have an actual, we shine some light into that black box and get some real understanding of how these chemicals actually do what they do. So we won't be mystified. All of these things are facilitated by being able to make careful measurements in the laboratory. So I would suggest that the best of all possible worlds is having both. Mm-hmm. That what we learn in the laboratory can complement our field experience, and taken both together, we'll have the best overall understanding of how these chemicals and techniques work, and that will enable us to best optimize our use of them.
Yeah. You know, when I think about, you know, this idea between what happens in the lab and what happens in the field, the thing that flashes in my mind is this idea of the eutectic temperature, right? Or this eutectic point, you know, this theoretical point where, you know, you get the maximum benefit of the material. It doesn't always quite work out that way in the field. And I think there's some misunderstanding about what the eutectic temperature really is all about.
I agree. In fact, I would say that in my 30 years of experience, I would say that the eutectic is probably the most commonly misunderstood factor or characteristic of de-icers. So a few thoughts about the eutectic. I guess the good thing is that even though it's commonly misunderstood, but maybe it doesn't matter that much because the eutectic is really rather limited in what it tells us. I mean, I could talk about eutectic from an actual chemistry standpoint, but I'd just as soon avoid a more nitty-gritty chemistry discussion. When I talk about eutectic, I prefer to think about it just in terms of the freezing point curve for de-icers, because that's really where it makes the most sense. Basically, the freezing point curve for any de-icer tells us how the freezing point of the brine changes with concentration. So it tells me if I've got a brine that's got 1% salt, 2%, 5%, 20%, so on, what is the freezing point of that brine at each of those percent salt concentrations. The eutectic is simply the lowest freezing point that you can get in water from any chemical. Mm-hmm. Now, that's important to us because that also is the lowest temperature that chemical can melt any ice. The main thing the eutectic tells us, it tells us the shutoff temperature for a given chemical, the temperature below which it won't melt any more ice. But a lot of misunderstandings come beyond that. So, for example, a fairly common misunderstanding is that the eutectic temperature is also the optimum brine concentration for ice melting. And that's not correct.
Oh.
That, in fact, if you go to the trouble of actually measuring the ice melting of a brine with a range of different salt concentrations, what you will find is that the eutectic concentration does not give you the most ice melting action, no matter what temperature that you're at. I will pose a question to you, Rick. Imagine you got a brine. So we know salt's got a eutectic concentration of 23%.
Right.
So if you got a brine of 15% salt, 23% salt, and 26% salt, which one of those melts the most ice at 10 degrees?
Well,
what would you guess?
I guess I would say that if it's in that zone, there it's all going to be the same, right?
Nope. What you will find is that the ice melting tracks right with the concentration of the brine. So the 23% will melt more than the 20%. The 26% will melt more than the 23%. Basically, the more chemical you got in the brine, the more ice it will melt. So if you think about it, that makes perfect intuitive sense. The more chemical that you got in the brine, the more chemical you're putting on the road, and the more ice it can melt. Now, having said that, why then do we use brines at their eutectic concentration? Because we often do. Very commonly, most mm-hmm. commonly, we use salt brine at 23%.
Right.
Mag and calcium chloride brines, we use at or near their eutectic concentration. So why do we do that? We don't do it to get more ice melting power. We do it to get storage stability.
Oh, okay.
Let's say you make a salt brine in the fall at 60 degrees, nice mm-hmm. fall day, and you're not going to use anything fancy. You just make a saturated salt brine, you store it in a tank. So all well and good. Now the temperature drops. And the temperature drops from 60 degrees down to 0 degrees. Well, the solubility of the salt at 0 degrees is less than it is at 60 degrees. So what's going to happen is if the temperature drops, now your brine is overly saturated and that excess salt's going to crash out.
Yeah, it just falls to the bottom, right?
Exactly. Or if you're making the brine in a shop or something, at a moderate temperature and you put it in saddle tanks and you take those trucks out and it gets very cold, now you've got solid salt in your saddle tanks getting sucked into spray lines and nozzles and this sort of thing. So if we start with a brine at the eutectic concentration, in the case of salt, it's going to be stable down to 6 below 0. By diluting the salt just a little bit, by diluting it from saturation, which is 26%, down to 23%, we buy ourselves an enormous amount of temperature storage stability. So that's one common misunderstanding of the eutectic. Mm-hmm. I guess the final comment I would make about eutectics is that the freezing point curve itself is enormously more important than the eutectic. So the eutectic is a single point on that freezing point curve. Any given point on that freezing point curve, if I know the freezing point of a brine of whatever concentration, from that I can calculate very accurately the ice melting capacity at that temperature. And the freezing point curves for our common chloride salts, they're readily available.
Mm-hmm.
The data is out there. It's straightforward to calculate the ice melting capacity. Pounds of ice that can be melted per pound of chemical at any temperature. You can calculate that easily from the freezing point curve. And if anyone wants to do that, I won't take the time to walk through that right now. It's a simple calculation. People are free to contact me if they wish. I'd be happy to show how to do that. But the bottom line is by using the freezing point curve, we can calculate very accurately how many pounds of ice melt we can get per pound of chemical, per dollar of chemical, per gallon of brine, per gallon of brine of a given blend. There's an enormous amount of information we can extract from the freezing point curve. Mm-hmm. The eutectic is just one single point on that freezing point curve and has limited value. Again, yeah. I primarily think of it as telling us the shutoff temperature for the de-icer. Yeah.
As soon as you put salt out there, it goes into solution, and as it melts, it continues to become more dilute, right?
Yes.
And so that concentration rate is going to go down, and at some point, you don't have enough material there, and whatever liquid you have refreezes.
If the temperature drops, so you're absolutely correct. So you put the salt on, you got some ice on the road, you put the salt on, let's say it's 15 degrees. You put the salt down. The salt will start melting the ice, and it will, as it melts the ice, it's going to dissolve the salt until the salt's completely dissolved. It's all in the brine. And then it's going to keep on melting that ice until it reaches its freezing point.
Right.
Until it's diluted to where the freezing point is 15 degrees. At that point, it's melted all the ice it can melt, and it can't melt anymore. So as long as the temperature stays 15 degrees and nothing funky happens, well, I guess you wouldn't have rain at 15 degrees, but as long as the temperature doesn't drop, that brine's just going to stay there. Mm-hmm. But if the temperature drops, now you're correct. Now there's no longer enough salt there to keep it melted at that colder temperature, and it will refreeze.
Yeah.
And so this is another thing that I think, I mean, maybe this is going to be one of the take-home lessons or points that I'm going to hammer on in our chat, is this is also something that we can get insight on from the freezing point curves. The freezing point curves will tell us how much ice melting we can get at a given temperature, and an understanding of at what temperatures refreeze will start to occur.
You know, when you talk about ice melting capacity and that sort of thing, I think one of the key points is you don't necessarily have to melt everything from the top all the way down in this winter operations business. All you have to do is disrupt that bond that occurs between the pack and the pavement surface, because we're going to be out there with mechanical means, you know, scraping and that sort of thing. Sort of the premise of this whole anti-icing discussion, right?
Absolutely. And that, you know, you're getting at the heart of what anti-icing is, and the whole insight behind anti-icing is that for the most part, the important work is all going on right at the pavement surface. This was really an interesting insight that I had early on when I first started working with de-icers for the first time. I did a little back of the envelope calculation to estimate how much snow was melted by a typical salt application rate. Let's say 200 pounds per lane mile. So I said, how much of a 1-inch snowfall is melted by 200 pounds of salt per lane mile? And I don't remember the exact answer to the calculation, but I do remember it was very small. It was something like, I don't know, let's say it was a few tenths of a percent of 1 inch of snowfall. What I thought, you know, what I reflected on was, if you knew nothing else, if you were the first person in the world to say, I think the answer to helping plow icy roads is to put salt on, and you went to your boss and said, hey, boss, here's this great idea. Let's put 200 pounds of salt down, and it's going to melt 0.5% of the snow. Well, they'd probably laugh you out of the room. But of course, we know from decades of experience that is actually extremely effective. And it's effective because, of course, we're not trying to melt 1 inch of snowfall. In fact, all we want to do, to the extent that we can, is just melt it right at the pavement surface so we can debond it and allow the plows or traffic action to actually do the work, to actually get it off the pavement. So, yeah, you need... the big insight of anti-icing is if you can get that chemical on the pavement surface before the snow falls, you need a whole lot less. In the real world, you can't always do that. In the real world, we often have a snowpack to deal with. And in that case, you have to do reactive conventional de-icing. Mm-hmm. But to a certain extent, we quote-unquote waste, if you will, some of that ice melting action just boring down to get to the pavement surface where the important stuff's going to happen.
Right. One of the things that is really, you know, it comes up in all the meetings, it seems to be a topic of conversation wherever we go, is this idea of organic-based performance enhancers, mm-hmm. you know, different kinds of organics that get blended in. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that? What's really happening with these organic-based performance enhancers in the mix?
So they're very popular, and they've been used for quite a few years, and people see real value in them. Where I would start is the one thing that they don't do is they don't seem to be very good ice melters. Mm-hmm. I've tested a number of them. I've never encountered any of the conventional organic-based additives that melt ice to any significant extent. I would not expect them to add effectiveness from an ice melting standpoint. But they do have a number of other benefits. One thing that they do is they function well as corrosion inhibitors. So they are often added to chloride brines in order to enable them to meet the standard Clear Roads QPL requirement for corrosion-inhibited de-icers, that they be at least 70% less corrosive than salt. Mm-hmm. And so they work well for this. Another thing that they appear to do well is to increase the residual effect when brine is applied directly to the road. Now, this is something that I don't think has been studied very much in the laboratory. And I think it would be interesting to look at that. We've got a lot of qualitative field experience that seems to pretty consistently say that if you add one of these typical organic-based performance enhancers to salt brine, it does a pretty good job of helping that brine resist being worn off by traffic action for a longer period of time. So if you apply a plain salt brine to the road and you're expecting the snowstorm to start in a couple hours and it doesn't, and instead it waits for a day to show up, ideally you'd like that salt brine to still be there on the road and ready to work when the snow finally gets around to falling. Mm-hmm. But what we find is that if you put plain salt brine down, that over time, traffic action gradually erodes it away and you have to reapply it. And the experience that I've heard from the field, and this is just kind of a summary of field experience, is that these organic-based performance enhancers will extend that quite significantly. That brine will remain effective on the road for a much longer time. Probably, the mechanism's not is probably just as simple as many of these organic additives are fairly sticky. It's probably something as simple as forming a sticky film on the road that helps to protect it from being abraded by traffic action. And then one other thing that is worth noting, while these organic additives are typically not very good ice melters, mm-hmm. they can function as an antifreeze. Oh, and okay. Antifreeze and ice melting are related to each other, but they're not identical. Now, you might ask, what's the difference? Like, if I put an additive in that's an antifreeze, but it won't melt ice, does that really help me? And I would say that, assuming that it does, that it certainly may. Mm-hmm. Because I think one of the main things that limits our use of brines is a point you touched on just a couple minutes ago. It's this refreeze business, especially at colder temperatures. And see, this is the challenge, Rick. It's at colder temperatures, the boost in ice melting speed that we get from liquids really starts getting beneficial. However, the colder it gets, the more liquid that we need to have the same ice melting performance. But the more liquid we put down, the greater the risk if it refreezes on us.
Okay.
When it starts getting cold. So this potential for refreeze is something that limits our use of brines. Now, if an additive will help to prevent that, if it will help to inhibit the refreezing of the brine, that in principle should extend the temperature range over which the brine can be safely used. This is another area that has not received a lot of laboratory detailed laboratory study as far as I know, and I think it would be interesting and valuable. But certainly I know that there's a lot of field experience saying that people find that adding these organic-based performance enhancers at colder temperatures does extend the performance of the brine. So my hypothesis, Rick, is that is due more to this antifreeze effect than an actual ice melting effect.
Yeah, all right. You know, as we're talking about temperatures, when I first got started using liquids, I was with the DOT, and this was back in the early days of the Strategic Highway Research Program. We were just trying to get it sorted out, this idea of putting liquids out during or just before the snowstorm. And we were using liquid mag chloride, a mag chloride brine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we went on, you know, we discovered that the operating temperatures that we were working with, you know, down here in the valleys of Reno really were more in tune with the performance that you would want just sodium chloride. And so we made the switch to sodium chloride at that point. But a lot of folks out there are using blends. They're mm-hmm. using different kinds of blends with sodium chloride as a base. What are some of the benefits of blending, and what are some of the risks? You know, it's like when you're using straight sodium chloride and you're putting it out as a solid, it seems to be very forgiving, right? You don't have a lot of opportunity for things to go really haywire. But as you get more and more exotic with your chemicals and your applications and so on, they become a bit less forgiving.
Sure. All right. So benefits and risks. So benefits of blends. I assume we're talking specifically about blends of calcium or mag with sodium chloride brine. Is that correct?
It's pretty much that's what I'm hearing folks doing.
Yeah. So blending calcium or magnesium chloride with salt brine will give us some incremental increase in ice melting capacity at colder temperatures. How much? Well, this is something, again, that can be calculated from the freezing point curves. One of the things that we found in our tests is that when you blend brines together, and this is and certainly for the chloride brines, and I suspect it's true for anything. I'm actually doing some explorations around that at the moment. But certainly when you blend chloride brines together, the effect on ice melting is simply additive. There's nothing magical going on. You can't add 5% calcium chloride brine to salt brine and make it work 10 times better. It doesn't work that way. In fact, it appears that it's simple as if you blend brine A and B together, what you get, the ice melting of the mixture, is basically just the sum of the ice melting from each individual component. I've seen little evidence of any kind of magic synergism going on. So having said that, at lower temperatures, you will get an incremental increase in ice melting capacity by adding some magnesium or calcium chloride to the salt brine. That can have some benefit at colder temperatures when it's being used as a direct ice melting material. But I think even more interesting is the effect when we are pre-wetting. One of the benefits of pre-wetted rock salt is that wet salt melts ice faster than dry salt does. And that is not something that we should dismiss too lightly, since there are two main things that limit the effectiveness of our de-icers. One is the ice melting capacity, the total amount of ice melting power available at a given temperature for any chemical. And that's carved in stone. It just is what it is, not a thing you can do to change it. And that drops with temperature. Okay. The other thing that limits us is ice melting speed, how fast the chemical can melt the ice. This is also temperature dependent. De-icers typically get slower the colder it gets, and some de-icers more than others. And it turns out that rock salt will become very slow as the temperature drops. So this is a problem, because any salt that we put down on the road that has not had enough time to release all of its available ice melting action before it's knocked off by traffic or pushed off by the plow, that's wasted salt. It's salt that we've paid for in dollars and in environmental impact, but for which we're not getting any benefit. So the bottom line is, while we can't do anything about ice melting capacity, we can do something about ice melting speed.
Okay.
Ice melting capacity is carved in stone. Speed is not. And if there's anything we can do to speed up the ice melting action of the rock salt, we are going to essentially have a lower effective working temperature, and we're going to extend its effectiveness. And it turns out that we know one really good way to do that, and that is by making the salt wet. Wet salt melts ice faster than dry salt. And if I may circle back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, when you're asking why do lab experiments, why study these things in the lab? This is a perfect example of an insight from the laboratory that would be really difficult to get based on field observations alone. What we've learned in the laboratory is that we can actually measure how different brine blends at different brine application rates affect the speed of rock salt's ice melting. And what we find, now coming to the question of blends, is that the more calcium and magnesium chloride are present in the brine, it appears the faster the ice melting we get from the rock salt at particularly at colder temperatures. So I think there is real value to having some calcium or magnesium chloride in the brine to better activate the ice melting action of the salt and pre-wetted salt at cold temperatures. So that is the benefits. What are the risks? So just
before you go into the risks,
though,
that's where maybe my thinking wasn't quite right, you know, back in the day, because I was purely thinking about it from a capacity point of view, not a speed point of view. You know, I think that's really insightful, you know, thinking about that in the past.
Yes. I think that ice melting speed is a factor that's not given sufficient attention in terms of being a lever that we can optimize. Because again, there's nothing you can do to change the capacity. If you know that 100 pounds per lane mile gives you just what you need at, I don't know, let's say 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and the temperature drops to 10, to get that same amount of ice melting action, have the same performance, the only thing you can do is add more salt. There's no way around it. Mm-hmm. However, if we're being limited by speed, which we almost certainly are with dry rock salt at cold temperatures, that's a lever that we can adjust by making that salt wet, by wetting it, especially with magnesium calcium chloride. We can speed up the action of the salt and extract more usefulness out of it.
How much should we be pre-wetting with? You know, there's a lot of discussion. You know, you want to stir up discussion over your favorite adult beverage. Just say, "Oh, I only pre-wet at 3 gallons per ton or 10% per weight."
So this is yet another example of a question that can be addressed in the laboratory, but very difficult to address in the field. We have been looking at this question in our laboratory, and I will give you a quick summary of some things that we've learned. So we did the following experiment, Rick. We made a pre-wetted rock salt. We wetted rock salt with a magnesium chloride brine, okay? And we used a range of different pre-wetting quantities, from a low amount of pre-wetting mag chloride brine to a very high amount of pre-wetting brine. And we measured the ice melting speed of the rock salt. Now, we measured this under what I would call worst case conditions, a very cold temperature. Actually, we actually ran these tests at 4 below 0. And without any simulated traffic action. So something we haven't talked about yet is traffic action. Traffic action is another very important factor in de-icing performance. But if we have no traffic action to help us, it's very cold. That's the worst possible. That's the most difficult, challenging conditions. So what we found was that above a certain level of pre-wetting liquid, when we went higher, we had no further benefit. We could keep jacking up the amount of liquid we were putting on. The ice melting speed was the same. So it looks like, yes, indeed, under these worst case conditions, again, no traffic action, no mixing, it looks like there is an optimum ratio of brine to salt. And I don't have the number in front of me, but it turned out that it was in the range of what is sometimes used for slurry de-icing or shake and bake de-icing in the field. So there's some consistency with that. But the really interesting thing was that this quote unquote optimum level of brine, the level of brine above which we got no further benefit, it happened to also be the level of brine that was enough to completely cover all of the ice. Now, so what?
All of the salt, right?
No, all of the ice. All of the whole ice pavement surface.
Okay.
Now, let's think about that for a minute. What does that mean? What that means is that this is something, again, I would argue that this is yet another reason why these lab studies are important. This gives us insight on how pre-wetting works. And to make a long story short, the picture that emerges is that the liquid's doing all the work. And that jibe, I mean, that's in a sense, that's not really new, but we've really confirmed it. Mm-hmm. So it's always in the form of a brine that the de-icer is doing almost all of its work. And if you think about it, that makes sense. So imagine you've got a big crystal of rock salt sitting on the ice. The only place it can melt the ice is where the ice and the salt chemical are touching each other.
Right.
And as long as you've got a big chunk of crystal and salt, 99.99% of the chemical is all locked up inside that crystal. Once you've converted into a brine, now that chemical can much more efficiently spread out and contact the ice and melt it.
Okay.
So having said that, now this makes sense. We get the fastest ice melting action where I've got the most points of contact where liquid is touching ice. Because again, liquid's doing all the work. And rock salt's touching liquid. So the way I think about pre-wetted salt is the liquid's like a car. The liquid is getting us from A to B. The liquid is getting us from frozen ice to melted ice. The rock salt is the gas station. So that liquid can melt ice very fast because we get good, efficient contact between the ice and the chemical. But it can't melt very much. This is the big, what's the word that I want? The trade-off. So liquids, brines are the gold standard for fast ice melting. They are extremely fast ice melters, but we pay for that with lost ice melting capacity. Every bit of water that we add to salt to turn it into a brine is now that much ice we can no longer melt. So if I have nothing but brine on the ice, it's going to run out of steam pretty quickly. If I've got both brine and rock salt, that rock salt can keep dissolving in the brine as it's being diluted by the ice melting and replenishing it, refueling it, pumping more chemical into that brine and allowing it to keep working. This is why I think at colder temperatures, the best of all possible worlds is actually a mixture of both rock salt and brine.
In the brine.
And where was I going with that, Rick?
well, we were just about ready to launch into some of the risks.
Was there something else? Was there something else? I thought there was something else you were asking about.
Well, what the optimum rate?
Oh,
might
thank
be,
you, thank but- you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Yes. So the point that I wanted to make was that the liquid's doing all the work. That's the important thing to remember. The liquid's doing all the work. The rock salt's the gas station. And if I've got no traffic action to help me, we need a relatively high amount of liquid to get the optimum effect, because I need as many places as possible where liquid's touching ice and rock salt's touching liquid. Okay. Now imagine what happens if you've got traffic action. Now, to the extent that the salt stays on the road, we are continually mashing and grinding that salt and ice and liquid over and over with each other. That's going to enormously increase the points of contact between ice and salt and brine. And I fully expect that it's going to decrease the amount of brine, pre-wetting brine, needed for maximum effect. Now, you ask me how much that is, I don't know. We have not done those experiments yet. But directionally, that's what I would expect. So it may be that even modest amounts of pre-wetting, if there is traffic action to help, may go a long ways towards activating the salt, even at fairly cold temperatures.
Yeah, okay. So when we're talking about risks, I was at one of the TRB webinars or seminars that took place, and I want to say it was like pre-COVID, and you happened to be there, and you were talking about liquids. And it sort of came up, the question was sort of, well, if I'm making this liquid brine that's made up of sodium chloride and calcium chloride or magnesium chloride, if I've just put more magnesium chloride or calcium chloride in that brine mix, it would be that much better, right? And mm-hmm. And I think there's some interesting chemistry that could take place.
Are you talking about the brine blend stability talk?
The brine that blend stability, yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So what I was talking about there was this issue that a number of people have experienced, where sometimes when you blend calcium chloride with salt brine or magnesium chloride with salt brine, they find that you mix the two brines together, you have two nice, clear, beautiful brines, you mix them together, and all of a sudden you've got something that... Yes. Thank you. That's where you were going. Yeah. You got a mess. You got, a mess. I've heard it referred to as snot, not to put too fine a spin on it. So yes,
happening? What's going on?
What's going on is I'm going to give you the fancy chemistry, explanation. So it sounds like I really know what I'm talking about. And then I'm going to give you the more simplified explanation. That's an example of what we call the common ion effect, which is in turn an example of what we call the Chatelier's principle. And so now that I've said the big sounding words, let me try and explain it in simple terms.
Okay.
So water will only hold so much chemical. When we dissolve a chemical, you can't keep dissolving chemical in water forever. Sooner or later, it will get saturated. And some chemicals will dissolve more than others. So in particular, we're talking sodium chloride and calcium chloride. You can get more calcium chloride into water than you can sodium chloride. So if we start with a standard salt brine, it's going to be about 23%. That's fairly close to saturated already. Now we're going to start adding a concentrated calcium chloride brine. Well, what's happening now is now you've got two different salts in water. One of which likes water more than the other. Okay, so you've only got so much water to go around, and so these two different chemicals are going to compete for that water to dissolve them, and the one that is more water soluble will win that competition. So okay. If you add too much calcium chloride to your salt brine, what's going to happen is that mixture is going to go, well. And there's now more ions floating around here than I can keep in solution. So I'm going to keep the more soluble ones at the expense of the less. So basically what happens is at some point, if you add too much calcium or mag chloride to the brine, you're going to start forcing salt out to make room for the calcium chloride. And so that's what's causing this mess, if you will. You're getting fine, tiny crystals of sodium chloride crashing onto the brine. They're small enough that they will remain suspended in the brine for a time, and they give it this milky kind of suspension look. So that's what's going on. And it gets worse at colder temperatures. The colder it gets, the more sensitive it is to this. But there is a solution to that, and that is if you dilute the salt brine a little bit before you add the calcium chloride, you can make room for more of that calcium chloride. And there are a number of brine makers on the market that allow the user to dial in the concentration that they want. This could be an instance where it would be potentially useful to do something other than a standard 23% salt brine. It might make sense to dial it down a little bit if you want to add a significant amount of, say, calcium or magnesium chloride.
Scott, I want to thank you for working with me and coming on and explaining some of the stuff that's going on with salt. If it's okay with you, I'm going to put your email address out in the show notes if mm-hmm. people have specific things they want to reach out to you about. You've got a very popular section there on the Cargill website called Ask Dr. Scott, and there's a lot of really great explanations and answers to a lot of these frequently asked questions already there. So I would encourage folks to go over there and see what you've got to offer.
Super. Yeah, that's perfectly fine, Rick. And thank you as well for inviting me. This has been really fun, and I would be more than happy to try and answer any further questions that people have. Feel free to contact me.
All right. Again, Scott, thanks a bunch.
My pleasure, Rick.
If you like this episode, share it with your colleagues, and while you're at it, click subscribe on your content provider so you'll never miss an episode. If you'd like an email letting you know when the next episode gets posted and be in on other communications from the Winter Weather Management TSP, you can sign up at talkinwinterops.org/subscribe. That's TALKIN winterops, all one word, .org/subscribe, where you can sign up to get all the communications Talkin' Winter Ops. There's a link in the show notes, too. This podcast is possible because there are state departments of transportation across the nation that make a $4,000 contribution to support the AASHTO Winter Weather Management Technical Service Program, formerly known as PSYCOP. It's because of your support that PSYCOP Talks Winter Ops and all the other resources from the Winter Weather Management TSP are there to help you achieve your winter maintenance mission. PSYCOP Talks Winter Ops is intended for general information purposes. References to any specific company, product, or organization does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by PSYCOP or AASHTO. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individuals alone and don't necessarily reflect the views of AASHTO or any of its officials. Until next time, thanks for tuning in and stay safe out there.